This is WPKN 89.5, WPKN.org.
Welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. I am your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com. You can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on the In Context Report channel on YouTube. With me in the studio is In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And behind the board this afternoon is Dell. Thank you very much, Dell. Our first order of business is a big thanks to our listeners who contributed so generously to our very successful on-air fundraiser last week. WPKN is listener-sponsored, and it's your contributions that not only keep WPKN's unique offering of music on the air, but also our independent and original public affairs programming. And if you've not had the chance to show your support, you can still do so by going to WPKN.org and making a tax-deductible contribution. Thanks very much for your help. As this is the last Monday of the month, In Context brings you our monthly War Report, the only show of its kind on the radio. In the War Report, we describe the latest important developments in the global war, developments that are often unreported in the rest of the U.S. media. And further, we explain the larger military and geopolitical significance of this war news so that you can understand how this news might affect our country and each of us personally. One of the important military developments in this month was the Department of Defense decision to open many combat decisions to women soldiers, and we'll be talking about this in a few minutes. And we'd like to know what you think about women in combat and other military issues when we open our phones. First, let's take a look at what's been happening in the wars recently. Marshawn, I'd like to start with Afghanistan. Last week, there was a nine-hour gun battle in the middle of Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, a country we've been occupying for what now, 12 years. What does this say about the state of our grip on Afghanistan and our occupation?
Well, I think that it shows that Obama's whole plan to draw down the troops is really a farce, because I think what's happening is, unlike in Iraq what President Obama did is he made a deal with Muqtada al-Sadr, the head of the Mahdi army, which was the largest resistance movement in Iraq.
These are the Shiites.
The Shiite movement. And he said to al-Sadr, listen, we'll cut you a deal. We'll let you be part of the government. You lay down your arms. We'll let you, you know, get involved in politics. And Sadr said, no, that's not the way it works. We keep our arms, but we'll stop killing your soldiers if you let us be part of the government. So President Obama cut a deal. And ultimately for al-Sadr, it made more sense because it was going to be a lot less costly for him. He could take over the government from the inside, you know, so on and so forth. And he knew we would do anything so as not to have our troops killed. So when it came to keeping 15,000 troops behind, the al-Sadr said, no, if you do that, we'll attack them. So Obama just withdrew all the troops. But it was able to give President Obama the facade of having been victorious in Iraq. In Afghanistan, on the other hand, President Obama met with the Taliban in Qatar, which, ironically, according to the National Defense Authorization... American officials.
American officials are meeting with Taliban.
No, met, past
met,
tense.
Okay, in Qatar. The U.S. ally
which,
in the Persian
according
Gulf.
According to the National Defense Authorization Act, makes President Obama and his entire administration liable to arrest under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012.
So people don't generally know that we've been conducting negotiations, peace negotiations behind the scenes with the Taliban through our surrogate Qatar in the Persian Gulf.
It was kept very hush-hush, but if you go onto Google and you look up Taliban-U.S. negotiations in Qatar, it comes up. But what's interesting, so, I mean, President Obama's violating his own law because part of the National Defense Authorization Act says that any negotiations, any talking or relationship with the Taliban or extremist organizations makes you liable to arrest. Well, that's kind of what they did. But what's interesting, though, is I think Obama was hoping to get a deal like he did with al-Sadr. Now, the Taliban basically snubbed him. They told him to go to hell because the Taliban, this is what the situation in Afghanistan is like. Negotiating with the Taliban now is kind of like the German army trying to negotiate during the fall of Berlin. The Taliban said, look, you guys are on your way out. You're leaving anyway. We know you're leaving anyway. Why would we negotiate when we know as soon as you leave, we're going to take Kabul? You know, so the negotiations were an abysmal failure. And so as a result, what then President Obama did, he decided, well, I'm not going to mention that. I'm not going to talk about that. We got to kind of overshadow in the U.S. media. And he decides, I'm going to have a drawdown. I'm going to hand control of the country over to the Afghan National Army, the Afghan National Police.
Sounds a little bit like Richard Nixon in the early 70s with the Vietnamization of the Vietnam War.
Well, the difference was, though, is that the Vietnamese actually did fight. If it hadn't been for Nixon having the plug pulled on him because of Watergate and Congress taking away his power to act and the airstrike stopping, South Vietnam would have probably held out for a considerable length of time.
So you're saying there's really very little genuine support for the American occupation of Afghanistan amongst the locals?
Well, that's what it's not just amongst the locals. It's among the locals. People forget it's not that they support or don't support the Taliban. It's they support whoever has the guns. It's that simple. You know, some bunch of guys roll in a Jeep, whether they're Americans or Afghan National Army or Taliban, they have the guns, you got nothing. You're going to do whatever they say so they don't kill your family. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm talking about is the Afghan army. The Afghan army knows that we're handing control of the country over to them. So we say this sector of operations is yours, Afghan National Army, Afghan National Police, you guys control this, right? So then the Afghan National Army, the Afghan National Police say, look, we know the Americans are going to be gone soon. If I fight the Taliban in this territory, well, first of all, Kabul is going to fall anyway, and I and my entire family will get killed. So instead, what I'm going to do is collaborate with the Taliban to protect my family. And so what's happening now is we're seeing Mao's fourth principle of guerrilla warfare. Mao Zedong wrote a brilliant book. He was a despotic tyrant. I'm not trying to glorify him in any way. Just want to make that point. Mao wrote, though, a brilliant guide to guerrilla warfare. And one of his points was first establish safe zones for training, begin securing the countryside. And then, eventually down the list, it's, you know, once the countryside is secure and you have an area of operations and freedom of movement, now you start attacking the cities. Well, because the Afghan National Army, the Afghan National Police don't want to fight because they're being coerced or they're being killed. So they're surrendering the countryside to the Taliban. The Taliban have free reign over the countryside. Now they're able to start launching attacks inside the cities. And this 9-hour gun battle we saw is really unique in so much as a group of Taliban fighters storm the traffic police headquarters. They bring with them an arsenal of weapons. I mean, this is unheard of. They brought with them RPGs, RPK light machine guns. They brought, you know, Kalashnikovs, thousands of rounds of ammunition, and they held off NATO and Afghan forces for 9 hours. The only reason they were able to bring all those weapons to Kabul is because we don't control the countryside. Back early on in the war, when we had checkpoints set up all up and down the roads, they never would have made it into Kabul. But now we've surrendered the country basically to the Taliban, but we don't call it that. We say that we're handing control over the Taliban. So it's much more analogous to the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, where they started pulling back into the cities. They said, well, forget it. We're never going to control the countryside. Let's back up into the cities. But that's the story of Afghanistan.
So meanwhile, our soldiers are still at risk. In fact, more at risk as they get more of them are shot by our supposed Afghan allies. So we're just going to have to watch that again, I see how that situation evolves or devolves, as the case may be. Meanwhile, there have been important developments in the Syrian war, which, as we've been covering for a year and a half now, the fact that it's essentially a surrogate war between Russia and the United States for control of Iran's key ally in the region. And ultimately, the prize is Iran and control of the Persian Gulf oil and of course, the newly discovered natural gas resources in the region, too. The latest seems to be that, you get different views on what's going on in Syria, depending on whether you read the foreign press, like the Israeli press, or the New York press. Now, the New York press did an article on January the 21st, which said that essentially said that Syria was the Assad government, the government of Syria, was on the verge of collapse, and that the Russians were sending their planes to Syria in order to evacuate Russian civilians. This indicates the Russians are concerned that Assad doesn't have very much time left. Meanwhile, though, Debka, this is the Israeli military intelligence newsletter that we often cite, Debka.com, indicates that there's an imminent counterattack planned by Assad, that he's very confident that he's coming close to wiping out the rebellion. He's on the verge of launching a big armor attack that's going to finish them off. And this is going to be done, according to Debka, with substantial support from Iranians and Russians. So which side do we believe? Which view of this Syrian situation should we believe?
Well, I think let's use just some rudimentary logic. The New York Times journalist was most likely in the writing from within the United States, or maybe at best writing from within Israel. Meanwhile, Debka's intelligence sources are citing Israeli military intelligence sources who have guys most likely on the ground in Syria. So I'd be far more inclined to believe the Israelis on this one, especially since just looking at the facts. I mean, this is the what we're hearing from the American media at this point is getting asinine. It really is, because we've been hearing for the last 2 years, Assad's about to fall, he's almost dead. I mean, this is really like the Germans in 1944 going, we're just about to turn the Soviets back.
If he's still alive, it's not because we haven't tried to kill him, I imagine.
No, not at all. The fact is, though, is that the reason why he's still alive is because he's under the protection of the Russians. And again, according to Debka, according to Haaretz, according to the British Independent, there are reports, and significant reports, of thousands of Russian troops in Syria. And not to mention
the Quds forces from Iran there have been reported to be there as well.
According to Russia Today, according to even the American press, according to Fox News even. And then you look at also thousands of Russian tanks have deployed, Russian Iskander missiles. Again, this is according to Russia Today, RIA Novosti, according to Debka.
And we talked in detail about the Iskander missiles on our recent show. They are the state-of-the-art theater-level guided missiles that are probably superior to what we have in the field right now.
Well, because they're hypersonic. Our Patriot missiles can't shoot them down because they're hypersonic.
And they're reportedly on the borders, stationed on the borders of Syria, targeting American positions in the neighboring countries.
Yes, and you can't exactly give these to some farm boy and say, fire it. It's not like an RPG. It's manned by Russians. That's what the Israelis say. It has to be.
So now,
but I think another thing I want to point out is that there's a Russian fleet of over 15 warships off the Syrian coast. That's why our fleet left the Syrian coast, was because there were 15 Russian warships there. And this is the largest fleet assembled in the 21st century.
Now, Israel has raised, as reported in Debka this morning, has raised the idea of chemical weapons. That's come up over several months now as perhaps a reason for U.S. or Israeli direct intervention in Syria. The argument goes that unless something is done, the chemical weapons of the Syrian government will fall into the hands of perhaps the Hezbollah, who are Syria's allies in Lebanon, or perhaps into the hands of these Islamist, these jihadist fighters who, ironically, we put into Syria.
And we did it to overthrow Gaddafi, like we gave guns to bin Laden. I mean,
exactly.
A point
we've come back to, the irony of that over and over again, that it's chemical weapons then, what could be the pretext for war? There's been this elaborate dance going on for a long time now, with Israel really pushing the United States to attack Iran, to intervene more heavily in Syria. Is this just another game that the Israelis are playing to try to get us more involved?
I think what was holding off an attack before was you had the American elections in November, so President Obama was being very indecisive. He didn't want to risk an American attack on Syria going completely pear-shaped and, you know, making him look a right pig's ear. And at the same time, the Israelis were having their elections in January, so they were afraid of the same thing. So now that the American presidential elections have happened, now that the Israeli presidential or parliamentary elections have happened, the Israelis and the Americans are in a position where, well, the Israeli and American governments are in a position where we can attack Syria or eventually Iran and not have to worry about the political ramifications for quite some time. I think at this stage, the question, it's really the case of the tail wagging the dog. You're not really sure whether it's the Americans telling the Israelis, we need to strike Syria and not get their chemical weapons, or whether it's the Israelis telling the Americans, because I'm hearing both in the reports I'm reading in
It could be just another one of these chemical weapons scare stories, but we won't know until the attack starts, and that it's the real deal. Now, we mentioned Iran earlier. Quickly on Iran, they just launched a spaceship carrying a monkey. No, and yep. What does this say about their ballistic missile capabilities?
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, I just want to bang my head into a wall, because the American media, I was checking this morning, I was looking at Fox and CNN and all the rest of it, and there was no report of this missile launch, of this putting this monkey into space. It had gotten to the point where it's kind of like fingers in the ears and la 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 la. I can't hear what's going on. Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil kind of thing. Because the what I was reading in the Russian press and in the Israeli press and in the even the Iranian press was that this missile launch is huge. Because not only did they launch a living being into space, but, and it came successfully back down alive. This is the first time Iran's ever done this because they had a few failed attempts. But it's huge because it means that if you can put a living monkey in there, you can put a ballistic warhead in there. And the advantage is that if you launch into space, it's almost free game anywhere in the world. Because the thing is that you can't just on a whim say, Iran's put something up into space, we're going to shoot it down. No, because the Iranians could say it's a satellite. The thing hurtles around Earth and then drops right over New York City. By the time it starts plummeting to the Earth over New York City, it's too late to stop it. The thing will plummet and hit us. And so it means that it gives the Iranians a global reach. Well, at this point, I think it's gotten so frightening that the American press is just literally, at least for the time being, decided not to cover
Iran
it.
Iran is not Iraq, which we, of course, walked over in 2003, debilitated by years of economic blockade with using antiquated weapons. Iran is much better equipped than Iraq. So a U.S. attack on Iran would be a much more serious affair.
Oh, absolutely. But I think also what we're looking at is the possibility that Iran could hit us at home now for the first time, and the possibility that North Korea could hit us at home. North Korea also for the first time launched a missile up into space, and the new North Korean premier, Kim Jong-un, unlike his father, has begun modernizing the country, brought in internet, brought in cell phones, and now he's saying, we are making no bones about this. We are designing, that was a ballistic missile test designed to hit the United States. We are going, he says, to test a nuclear weapon. And that's according to Fox News. We're going to test he said Kim Jong-un, the dictator, of North Korea, we're going to test a nuclear weapon. It's designed to be used against the United States, so are our ballistic missiles. What are you going to do about it? And the reason why they're doing this is because they know that both the Obama administration, well, especially the Obama administration, but even, you know, the American intelligence agencies know what's going on, but the Obama administration is entirely and utterly reluctant to actually strike out against North Korea. North Korea sank a South Korean warship, killed 30 sailors, attacked a South Korean island. This was a couple years ago.
Yes.
And attacked a South Korean island with artillery, and we told South Koreans, you can't do anything. So clearly, we are in no position and have no desire for a major war. So the Iranians and the North Koreans all know that they can develop these weapons and we won't touch them. But it does give them the reach to touch us. And again, the North Koreans also know that, let's say they hit us, or let's say they use these to hit Japan or hit South Korea, they know that they will be dragging us into a war we are totally unprepared for. What we want, the strategy now under the Obama administration, is to topple governments like Syria and eventually take out Iran with either surgical airstrikes or using hired mercenaries, the same way we overthrew Gaddafi in Libya, the same way we funded those insurgents, by the way, who we funded in Libya are now fighting us in Mali.
Well, let's get to that. But before I do, I just want to remind listeners that they just joined us that you're listening to In Context, live public affairs call-in show. We're on Mondays on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live WPKN.org. We're on Mondays from noon to 1 p.m. every Monday except the first Monday of the month when our general manager, Steve, gives his report to the listeners. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. And on In Context, on the last Monday of the month, we review the latest developments in the global wars, and we talk about their significance, their geopolitical significance, their military implications, in a way that I don't think you're going to hear on any other media, in whether it's radio or TV. We've just been reviewing the latest developments in Syria, in Afghanistan, and with respect to Korea. And Marshawn, you just raised the matter of Africa. That is extremely complicated. It's coming onto the scene. I don't think Americans are at all aware of how deeply involved we have been, from a military sense, in Africa, really since 9/11. President Bush Jr. created in 2007 something called the U.S. Africa Command. It's one of our regional military commands. This was to bring together a fairly long-standing involvement in Africa, to bring it under one command. It's headquartered, of all places, in Stuttgart, Germany. But the idea is that it's an umbrella group which is coordinating all sorts of military operations in Africa. And we're now finding ourselves, and these include, and you can go just to the U.S. Africa article if you would like to see it on Wikipedia, and it lists many of the operations that we're involved in Africa, and you're probably unaware of them, but just this past December, we announced that we are going to be sending in 2013 U.S. military personnel to 35 countries. That's right, 35 countries in Africa. We have a very large base in Djibouti, which is a very important command center for our African efforts. And while our troops are being sent there, they're being told in a capacity of training local troops, providing logistical support. The defense secretary has the authority to put them into combat by signing an order in a combat in African wars. And this is not going to be debated in Congress. There's going to be no declaration of war. Once again, we'll find our troops getting shot at, bleeding and dying in Africa, just with a stroke of a pen by someone in the executive department.
Well, and, which I think is also interesting, is that that's how the Vietnam War started.
We inch our way.
It was originally a... We were just sending advisors to help them. And by 1968, we had a million men there.
That's right. And you mentioned Mali, and that seems to be, we've had troops in various other countries in Africa, but Mali seems to be where the serious war, and of course we attacked Libya, we overthrew the government of Libya just last year, but Mali, the French army, principally, are supporting the government of Mali in fighting a rebellion in the northern part of Mali, which is basically Islamic. It seems to be led by Islamic elements. The African Union has pledged to send troops to support the government of Mali, but the French are there right now big time. They evidently do not have the air power, the aircraft necessary to bring their troops in, to refuel their planes. So now the United States has intervened in the Mali war by providing logistical support for the French. Whether this will turn into a combat presence, we don't know. We should note, though, that we have been involved in hostilities in Somalia in conjunction with the Ethiopian army as well as the Kenyan army. So there is precedent for a higher degree of an involvement. And one of the ironies, as we try to take apart and understand this Mali situation, is where are these insurgents getting their guns from that are fighting the Mali government in the northern part of Mali?
Well, that's what I think is so ironic, is that what's going on now in Mali is that we're fighting the same people we gave guns to overthrow Gaddafi. I mean, this is really this whole thing is like it's almost like a Cheech and Chong routine, to be honest. You know, it really is. Well, we're going to give guns to these people to overthrow this guy, so that then we can use them as an excuse to fight this guy. It's literally bordering on the absurd.
And all these groups pop up.
We overthrow Gaddafi using the Islamic militants that we claim to hate.
What was the name of that group? The Islamic fighting group?
They became the Islamic fighting group was dissolved and became something else when we started funding them.
But they were jihadists in Libya that we used to overthrow Gaddafi,
yes, but
right?
That's the point I'm trying to make, is that these guys, we give them guns, we give them money, we give them special forces training. They overthrow Gaddafi. We go, great, not our problem anymore. And then they go down to Mali. And then we go, wait, you guys can't go to Mali. You know, they take hostages in
Algeria. And of course, these groups always come up with new names. They're not called the Libyan Fighting Group now in Mali. They're called the Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb. Okay, it's called AQIM for short. Well, now, it's interesting to note, in 2007, the leader of Al-Qaeda, this is Zawahiri, that he stated that there was been a merger between this Islamic Maghreb group and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. Okay, they're essentially the same group. Okay, now one was our ally, as you March just said, in Libya. Now the other is the evil threatening force in the northern part of Mali that we must move heaven and earth to stop. And they're using guns, as you said, that they got probably from NATO. Or perhaps looted from Gaddafi's arsenals.
The most important thing that they got was the training from our special forces when they were fighting Gaddafi. Because that's something, you can give an idiot a gun and he can fire away with it and never hit a darn thing. But if you give somebody the wherewithal to use that gun to small unit operations and all the rest of it, then now that you've given them a far, far more deadly weapon, and they can pass that on. And that's exactly what's happening. We've not only given these guys guns, but we've trained them. Now they have guns, special forces quality training, and now they're fighting us. But that's the exact same thing. History repeats itself, although with us to a comical extent. We did the same thing when we gave guns and special forces training to Al-Qaeda and those elements and Osama bin Laden and those elements fighting the Soviets. We gave them training. We forget that we also, the Iraqi army before during the Iran-Iraq war, we gave them guns and training. And then, you know, you also look at, I'm trying to think of another really good example. But there are numerous examples. I mean, look at the Egyptians now. The Egyptians are having a tremendous amount of civil unrest, and we give them F-16s and 200 Abrams tanks. Like, how much sense is this all making?
Well, I think you asked a good question. If it doesn't make any sense to you, and it doesn't make any sense to me, it probably doesn't make any sense to our listeners either. So I think that we need to start thinking about what kind of foreign policy we have before we start putting American young men and young women into harm's way.
But I think that's just the problem. The American people are never asked. The American people are never asked, and they accept it blindly. This is how dictatorship begins. You see, democracy only works when people are involved. You have to be involved in your government. You have to be involved in your nation's decisions. Because to not vote is a vote. To not care about politics is an opinion in of itself. And I think one of the very important things that we need to look at is that the American people right now don't, by and large, don't seem to care. I have plenty of friends that say to me, oh, well, you know, we're in Afghanistan. Doesn't really matter. Are we in Afghanistan? And that is a vote. That's a vote in favor of executive rule. So if the American people won't speak up and say, we are opposed to having our troops in Mali when we can't defend our interests in Asia, when we can't defend our borders, if they don't speak up, the government's executive privilege is just going to expand.
So we do this show, and you're listening to In Context, a monthly war report on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org or on Mondays between noon and 1 p.m. We're trying to give you an update, not only the global wars, but we're hoping that in presenting all this information, much of which you're not hearing from the rest of the U.S. media, it'll provoke you to think about what kind of a defense policy we want in America, what kind of foreign policy we should have, and it's your country, and so let's get together and see if we can come up with a better way of running this country and involving ourselves in the world that we do now.
Well,
so
just Marshawn, get involved.
Just get involved. Marshawn, why don't we take a brief music break, and we come back and let's discuss the very important announcement by the Secretary of Defense that the Pentagon is going to lift its ban on women in combat, and we'll be giving the phone numbers out to see what people think about this and other issues. So, Del, could we go to some music, and we'll be right back.
Yeah, we'll go to break, and then we'll call at 203-336-9756 after the music. Be right back.
Judgment of our own.
And good afternoon. You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. This is In Context Monthly War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm here with our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. We've been reviewing important developments in the global wars all over the world, and that events that have happened in the last few weeks. And one, a very important military event happened here just a few days ago, and that was the announcement by the Pentagon that women will be allowed to take on many combat roles in the U.S. military. It's really paving the way for the largest expansion ever of women's roles in the front lines. So women will be allowed to serve in combat roles, but also military services will still be allowed to establish exceptions. So it should be noted that this isn't a blanket women equal men in every military position, but it is a very important milestone. Just to give people a little bit of background, 14% of all active duty military personnel today are women. And 152 women have died in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that would be since 2001, over the last 12 years. And it's important also to note that one of our congressmen, a representative from Illinois, Tammy Duckworth, was an Army pilot who tragically lost both of her legs in Iraq when she was flying her helicopter. So right in Congress, we have a very severely wounded combat veteran. So The new policy should allow women to serve alongside infantry troops as battlefield medics, for example, special ops pilots, and in other dangerous roles. There's still some debate about whether women can serve as regular infantry troops or particularly in elite special forces units. So, Marshawn, what is your take on this? Is this a wise decision?
Well, I think one of the things that's not...
Oh, excuse me, Marshawn, let me just announce our phone number, because if people want to weigh in on this, 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756, to call into In Context. Tell us your view about what do you think about the recent decision by the government to allow women in many more combat roles, women soldiers in many more combat roles. What do you think? Is it a good idea, a bad idea? Are women being given recognition that's due them, or is putting women at unreasonable risk? The phone number again is 203-336-9756. Tell us what you think. Or you can always, if you don't want to come on the phone, you can always drop us a line at ken@mdrtalk.org, and we will personally answer your message. It's ken@mdrtalk.org. So I'm sorry, Marshawn, I wanted to get your thoughts on, do you think, is this a wise decision to expand the role of women in combat?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting is that it's I think, largely a political move, because one of the biggest issues aren't being addressed. I mean, the fact is that I think before expanding the role of women into combat, one of the first things they have to do is, well, let's have an even physical fitness test, just Army-wide. Before we get women into special forces and into the infantry and whatnot, let's give everyone the same physical fitness standard, men and women. Let's face it, for a woman who's 21, 18 years old, she has to do her 2-mile run in 17 minutes and 36 seconds. A man who's 18 has to do his 2-mile run in 15 minutes and 36 seconds.
Oh, wait, does it stop? Stop. Wait. You mean that the Army has developed different standards for men and women with respect to passing their physical training?
Their physical fitness
test.
Would
they have to take this every year in the military? Or
Every 6 months.
I see.
And one of the things that's, borderlines on absurd is that a lot of these groups say, well, women should be in all the same jobs as men, which is fine, but everybody should have to make the cut. For example, if an 18-year-old male runs his physical fitness test in 17 minutes, they're not going to say, well, that's the female standard, you still pass. No, they're going to say, sorry, you're out, you're done, you're out of the Army. Whereas a female gets 17 minutes and 36 seconds to run what would fail a male. I don't think that's right. And that's part of the problem, is that in jobs like truck drivers and things like that, having different standards, you don't see the effect as much. But in something like special forces or the infantry, you got to ruck that weight. You got to walk that distance. You got to run that distance. The enemy in a combat specialty is not going to say, oh, you're a female, I'm going to go half speed. That having been said, I think So I think they have to look at that before they start, you know, we start getting ahead of ourselves and putting females into combat positions. Another issue, too, is the issue of things like, you know, sexual harassment and all the rest of it. You know, if you're putting women in a position that's predominantly male, you know, in the infantry in really remote places.
It's 14% of the service overall, but maybe in the infantry it'll be like 5% or something.
In really remote places and things like that. Now, special forces guys, some of whom I've met, have a very high moral standard. So I don't think there'd be any problem in that end. But in the infantry, I could see that being a problem. Infantry guys, some of them are great guys, but they can be kind of crude. And, you know, because what their job tasks them out to do is to be in the mountains for months and months and months on end with no access to civilization. So I could see it being a problem. The biggest problem of all, this was raised by the U.S. Army Surgeon General an article in the Army Times about 6 months ago or so, was saying that our bodies are physically different. Let's face it, our bodies are physically different. Namely, for a male to be out in, let's say, with special forces in the field. Now, helicopter pilots are different because they don't have to be out in the field as long. But for a male to be out in the field, in the middle of nowhere, hiding in the woods, training Kurdish rebels or something like that for weeks on end without access to a proper toilet or shower facilities is bad for his health. For a woman, it could be potentially deadly. And I'm saying this also as somebody who has some degree of medical experience. I was an emergency medical technician. I'm recertifying as an emergency medical technician. And for women who have their time of month, if you will, for lack of a better term, if they don't have access to proper hygiene, it can result in infection, and it can be potentially deadly. For a male, an infection under these environments can be potentially deadly as well. But for a female, the chances of getting an infection are higher. So the problem is it's being very politicized. None of these issues are being addressed. I'm not saying that women shouldn't be in combat specialties. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying we have to address these basic issues first.
How about carrying weight when it comes to the PT test? Is there a different standard for women carrying things, or is that not part of the PT test?
That's not, at least not yet. The Army was trying to figure a new physical fitness test that was going to be Army-wide. But
because I think it would be pretty hard for a woman who's, let's say, 110 pounds to carry a full pack it's hard for a smaller guy to do it. I mean, you could be 140 pound guy and you're carrying the same pack as a guy who's 200 pounds, which doesn't seem to be fair, but that's the way it goes.
Well, no, because that is the way it is. It is fair because, you know, a little guy, like, for example, I was a firefighter for many years, and I've worn many hats in my life, but when I was a firefighter, you either carried the hose or you didn't carry the hose. I was a little guy, and I was expected to carry, you know, the high-rise pack, which was about 100 feet or so, a fire hose, the same as a guy who was 6'2". And I was expected to wear the same equipment, because if I didn't, I'd get killed in the fire. Not only I would, but the other firefighters I was working with would. So either you made the cut and you did what you had to do, you carried the same weight, or somebody could get killed, and therefore you wouldn't go out on call. So now, did that mean there weren't roles for women in the fire department who were particularly small? No, there were plenty of roles. And certainly a woman could bulk up. I mean, I've met plenty of female firefighters and plenty of female soldiers who could make the cut because they were physically strong. The thing is just...
Let me give out the phone number one more time here, Marshawn. 203-336-9756. The name of the show is In Context. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. I'm here with Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, a military affairs commentator, and we're talking about the recent decision by the Pentagon to greatly expand the role of women in the military, allowing them to assume combat roles. So what do you think about that decision? Give us a call to 203-336-9756 to express your point of view. Marshawn, if I can ask you, how do other countries handle this?
Well, that's what I was getting to. What a lot of other countries do is, like in China, you either make it or you don't. The Chinese have all-female special forces units. These women are tough, and they scare the living daylights out of me. They are strong. They break bricks with their head. But that's because the Chinese say, look, either you make it or you go home. You know, you want to be a female in the military? That's fine. You make and break the same standards as a male does. And you know what? There are a lot of women that make the cut. There are a lot. And they are phenomenal soldiers. Similarly, they have female police officers in Iran who are really, I mean, these women repel, they carry a heavy combat load, they're really tough. But they're expected to meet the same standard. Russian army, same thing. Women aren't conscripted in Russia, but they're expected to meet the same standard. The Israeli army, it's the same thing. But that's because for the Russians, the Iranians, the Chinese, the Israelis, the North Koreans, the South Koreans, the Germans, the French, the women are expected to make the same standard because they're not politicized it. For them, it was always...
Well, do they have, in Europe, do they have women in combat units?
I believe so. I believe so. I've certainly seen. I don't know if they're members of the infantry.
I believe they do in Canada and Australia.
In the French army, I know they do.
Yes.
French actually have 15% to 20% of their military is actually female. But the fact is, though, is that they're all expected to meet the same standard.
And the Chinese army, for example, or the Israeli army, do they segregate women that are in carry guns?
In the Israelis because they can't afford to because their population's too small. But in the Chinese, they do.
So they have a women's only infantry regiment.
Absolutely, and they have women's only special forces units.
Well, that would deal with some of the harassment problem if you segregate people.
Oh, absolutely. I certainly think that if you have men and women separate in special forces or infantry units, you're going to have no sexual harassment complaints, or very few, very few. You should never say never, but you're going to have very, very few. And then the second issue is that if you make them meet the same standard as men, there'll be plenty of women who can. There'll be a lot who can't, just the same as there are a lot of men who can't.
Well, that's maybe why you see fewer women firemen as a percentage of firemen, because they do have to meet the same standards.
Well, that's also what I was saying.
We have a call on the line, gentlemen.
Hello, you're on the air, in contact.
This is Richard from Brookhaven, by the way.
Hi, Richard. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I have a question that I heard. First of all, I think it's an excellent show, and personally, I see you folks are doing is I get about 80-90% of my news from CBC, BBC, Deutsche Welle, Franz von Kott, and things like that. And I just find that it's a lot more reasonable as far as looking what's going on in the world, and doesn't necessarily see the world from the point of view that America is some sort of shining star on the hill that's right 99% of the time, but looks at things in a more reasonable way. But what I'm interested in is since, I believe, 1980, the tail end of the Carter administration, first the draft was abolished, I think in the 70s, and then I think Carter had it that you had to register to get, like, student aid or whatever, males had to do that. And I think for the past 30 years, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's been a ton of lawsuits out there from men saying that it was unfair that men had to register and not women.
That's right. All males have to register now.
Yeah, and also feminists saying, you know, hey, bud, you know what I mean? We're equal. We should have to register too. And the Pentagon has fought that tooth and nail. So what the question that I would raise, and I'll take my answer off the air, is in the international press, what they were saying with this opening up of the military in so many different ways and like that, they would think that it would have to be that females 18 to 25 would have to register too, understanding that a lot of males now don't even bother to register. But from what I understand with things like a driver's license and with federal student aid and like that, if you're a male and you don't register, you don't get it. So
I think it's a felony if you don't register.
Well, yeah. This is what I'm saying. But I think there's a lot of people out there who just try to fly under the radar or
sure.
don't know the difference or whatever.
Sure.
But my point being that, you know, I think with a lot of females it was that. Also, I guess the second part of my question is the American Friends Service Committee, or the Quakers, in the first years of the Bush administration were very, very concerned about some sort of a draft being started up by Bush, which never happened. But, I mean, if there would be a land war with Iraq or something like that, I think it would just take 2 or 3 weeks or so to get this going. And in that case, how would anybody say, and I think legal scholars have been saying around the world, how could the Pentagon say, well, women can be in all sorts of roles, but at the same time they can't be drafted?
Well, Richard, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you
very appreciate
much.
It.
Let me take this off the air.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And I certainly think that one of the biggest problems we have is that great debate. Do we draft women and do we draft men? I mean, in Israel, they draft men and women. In China, they draft men and women. In places like I'm trying to think where else. Oh, in places like Russia. Russia is a fine example. They only draft men. Women are voluntary. So, I mean, I could certainly see it going both ways. But the two major issues that we have to deal with is if we're going to have women serving in the combat MOS, combat military occupational specialty, like I say, that's perfectly fine. But the big issue is they have to be able to meet the same standard, and they and you have to have there has to be female conscription
and
as well.
And I'd like to go on record saying I'm against the draft. I think that I think we need.
I'm speaking purely from a technical perspective, but I
don't think we should have a draft. I think we should need a new foreign policy. But I believe we have a caller.
This should be Hattie from New Mexico, actually. Hattie, you with us?
Hi, Hattie.
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for your call. What's on your mind?
So, well, I think that the new changes will really put the U.S. more in line with Israel and other countries to draft women into combat roles. I believe that women who join the military are well aware that combat may be a possibility, and they feel obligated to serve alongside men. But I do agree with Marshawn on this point that if women are now being accepted into combat roles, then they should meet the same standards as men. I mean, the whole reason behind this is equality in the military. So how can you have full equality if women have different standards than men?
Well, and I think that's a very phenomenal point. And I think part of the problem that you have is that, and this is where it gets politicized and not practical. In China, like I said, in Russia, in a lot of other countries around the world, France especially, women are expected to make the same standard as men. If they don't, well, too bad, so sad, you're not getting in. And, you know, same as a man who can't make the standard. But the problem is that in the United States, politicians realize if they forced women to make the same standard as men, then fewer women would probably either enlist or get into combat specialties. And then they'll get attacked for being anti-women. So it's like it's a catch-22. You don't allow women into combat specialties, you're anti-women. You allow women in combat specialties, but say they must meet the same standards as men, you're still anti-women. So it is a catch-22, and again, with the draft as well.
Thank you very much for your call. It's Hattie from New Mexico.
Thank you very much.
So I guess our internet's stream must be working very well.
Well, we have gotten emails from Bahrain. So
that's,
I think
that's great. Well, thank you out there.
Thank you very much
for listening. And if you'd like to call in, do we have another caller on the line or no? Okay, we have only about 5 minutes left in the show. So if you'd like to weigh in on this issue of women in the military or yet another aspect of our report you'd like to talk about, give us a ring, 203-336-9756, 203-336-9756. The name of the show is In Context. This is our monthly war report, which we give it the last Monday of the month. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with our military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe, behind the board today. Helping us out is Dell. Thank you very much, Dell. And we're on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m. Yes, Marshawn.
And I think one point I'd like to make is, you see, though, it's not just with women in the military that you see this issue, though, of over-politicalization. Sorry, I'm stammering this afternoon. Politicalization. You're seeing that also with the technology we're investing in, too. We're investing in technology because it looks good, not because it's practical, because it makes politicians money or gets them votes. Same thing with this new F-35 jet, which is supposed to be phenomenal, with the exception of the fact that they discovered the thing will explode if it flies too close to lightning. That's wonderful.
How much
isn't
money
it?
Did that cost?
Billions. Billions.
Do we have another call, gentlemen? This is Bowen from Winchester.
Oh, Bowen. Hi, Bowen.
How you doing? I think I've called here before, haven't I?
Yes. Yeah, it's good to speak to you again, Bowen.
I just had to make kind of a comment on the last caller and another thing, too. But I don't believe that the idea of women in combat has to do so much with equality as it has to do with national defense. And if we have... we don't have the availability of an equal representation of those people who are able, then we don't have the national defense capability that we could. So it's not so much are women better than men or men better than women, should one do the other. It's whoever can do the job, no matter, should be qualified to do the job. And the other point, I agree with you with the idea that it's not that it's policy is where we need to go. And I think that the big impetus for both women in the military and gays in the military isn't so much the emotional context. It's that we are stretching ourselves so thin that somebody decided that, hey, we need to get everybody into the bag so that we can use all the cannon fodder we can, because we're not holding up on the policy end in the first place. And the intent seems to me, and it has for years seemed to me, that we intend to... to invade imperialistically and take what we want, and therefore we're stretched all over the damn world, and we've got a lot of opposition that we otherwise would not have had because folks don't like that.
And our army's pretty small.
And I think actually you make a phenomenal point, because that was the line of logic that the Israelis had, having such a small population. They said, look, we can't afford to have only men in the military. Like, we need everyone we can get. And I can definitely see it, because we have a very small military right now. And like you cited, we are stretched way too thin. There was, again, another article in the Army Times that said that right now the United States is incapable of responding to a major conflict or a major international emergency anywhere in the world because our forces are stretched way too thin. So thank you very much for your call. We really appreciate
that.
You
so much, Bowen. Thank you so much. We just have a couple minutes, but do we have a caller on the line? Now, I just want to mention that we do, although we do present very critical information about our government's defense policy and its foreign policy, we, Marshawn and I, have the greatest respect for the men and the women who are serving, whether they're abroad or at home, whether they're on active duty or in the National Guard or the Reserves. They're doing what they do not because they're going to make a lot of money. I mean, these guys are not in it for the dough. They are in it because they want to do something useful. They want to serve their country. So our hats are off to them.
Oh, absolutely. And please do not misconstrue my criticisms for, being anti-females in the military. I've known plenty of female soldiers. I've known some really tough ones, too. You know, the only reason I give the opinions I give, and I give it from a very technical perspective, is because otherwise people could potentially get hurt. And you don't want to see a very smart female soldier, just the same you wouldn't want to see a very smart male soldier who just is, for whatever reason, you know, a fortune of nature, too small to do that particular job, get hurt because of politics. They, you know, if they're too small to do that particular job, there are other jobs within the military for them. And maybe they're particularly
smart. There are many ways to serve. I mean, that's true, too.
Exactly.
Well, I'm afraid we have to leave it there, Marshawn. We're coming to the end. We're going to our PSAs. We want to thank Dell for handling the board today.
Thank you very much, Dell.
And we will be back in 2 weeks. Next Monday will be Steve DeCostanza, our general manager, will give his report to the listeners. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll check you out next time. And visit incontextreport.com.
Find us on Facebook.
May not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize them. Asia's crowded and Europe's too old. Africa's far too hot and Canada's too cold. And South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one, there'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia. Don't want to hurt no kangaroo. We'll build an all-American amusement park there. They got surfing too. Boom goes London and boom Paris. More room for you and more room for me. In every city, the whole world round will just be another